Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
You've gotten very good at the opening now, haven't you? I am Jazza. Hello, good to meet you, I suppose. I recently found out that I'm a nationalist. I'm just a nationalist that believes in the limited power of the United Kingdom on the international stage because I'm also a Ramona.
Who called you a nationalist?
A conservative friend of mine, actually, he's like, you're a bit of a nationalist, aren't you? And I was like, well, yeah, I would quite like to like Britain.
What did he mean by nationalist, or they mean by nationalist?
It was a he, so he meant that I want a powerful UK, and I want a powerful UK that has a say in its sovereignty. This was kind of the thing that, I'm not very happy about the Chequers Agreement, because it means that we become a weaker country.
UK PLC.
a weaker country on the international stage, and that's one of the big problems that I have with Brexit, because actually our voices, I feel like, get amplified within the European Union rather than pissed on, as many people would say.
So if you believe in the nation state, in an academic sense, you are kind of a nationalist, but obviously nationalist has a bit of a tang to it in terms of how people commonly use the word.
I think patriot may be a better word than I've used.
But patriot is, I don't know, I don't think
I'm
that's
go
says
out
quite
and
the
die
same
for my
thing.
Country. That's yeah. What it makes me think.
But would you die for the country? I'm not sure I would. I might just move away.
Well, so we're both cowards. Hello, welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. We talk about politics occasionally. I'm in the middle of writing a master's thesis. Actually, towards the end of writing a master's thesis, so please be kind about the fact that we haven't put any out very much over the summer. But nothing's really happened, so it's been fine.
A lot has happened, but it's sort of been
the
like...
same.
Yeah, it's been like an elongated version of, I don't know, some Pink Floyd song, just repeating endlessly.
Well, that's a musical reference that I don't really understand.
Oh, well, some people will, maybe.
Oh, yeah. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
So we're going to start off with this. The hook for this is...
Oh, can I do it?
What?
I'm a communist, you idiot!
Just so like the original.
I know, I've been practicing.
This is a reference to Ash, I'm going to probably mispronounce her surname, Sarkar, who is a Navarra media pundit of the far left. I mean, she described herself as a communist, so I think we can probably label
her Twitter bio says... luxury communism now.
I think that's intended as a goal. Somewhat ironically, but not entirely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So it's sort of like, you know, half joking. But anyway, she said this in response to Piers Morgan, who was accusing her of loving Barack Obama and not criticising Barack Obama enough when he was doing nasty things in foreign policy terms involving drones.
Mm-hmm.
He was accusing her of being a hypocrite, which, you know, I think was unfair. But her retort to this was to, don't want to say out herself as a communist, because I don't think she was ashamed.
I don't think she's ever had it hidden, to be honest.
But yeah, just to say, you know, I'm a communist. And I think it's kind of interesting because communist regimes have been responsible for quite a lot of bad things.
Mm-hmm.
But in British politics, the term doesn't have the same association as, say, fascist or Nazi,
right, yeah.
or whatever. Even though, you know, if you top the numbers, arguably the Italian fascists and even the Nazis are probably, I think, were actually responsible for fewer deaths than Russia during the communist period.
I don't think it particularly matters who killed more. Both killed.
It's kind of relevant, you know. It's
I'm not sure.
But it's interesting America. The different reputations they have. And actually, I think this is the first time in I don't know where you date it back to, but it's kind of surprising that we actually have pundits who are seeping into mainstream like shows and even newspapers, I guess, to a certain degree, who are openly describing themselves as communists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of an interesting change. So we're going to discuss that.
Yeah, and a lot of kind of like especially young activist Twitter are kind of realizing, oh my God, I'm a communist. I don't know how I feel about it. We'll talk about it later.
We'll talk about it later.
You want us to talk about Corbyn still being an anti-Semite or something?
Still,
or somebody,
still being an anti-Semite.
Somebody has accused him quite bluntly of being an anti-Semite. Break this down for me.
I can't remember which MP it was. Do you remember which MP it was that accused him? Can you do some quick Googling? And some nifty editing. Essentially, this, like, Labour have been in the process of redefining their definition of anti-Semitism.
Margaret Hodge.
Which is obviously controversial for all sorts of reasons, but they've adopted a new, or in the process of adopting a new version.
An anti-Semitism code.
Anti-Semitism code, which makes it, which deviates from a commonly used international standard, which is used by, say, the British police force and the courts in the UK. And the significant thing, at least from my point of view about it, is it actually makes criticism of Israel a little bit easier without falling into the definition of anti-Semitism. So I think it's the IHRA, I can't remember what that stands for, but that's the International Anti-Semitism Working Definition. And that includes, if you deny Israel's state a right to exist, that is seen as anti-Semitic, which I think that's a bit...
I have issues.
I think that's a bit questionable anyway. Yeah. But so they've adopted this new definition, which Labour have, which is a bit looser. It's a little bit less stringent. And obviously because this is coming against a backdrop of massive anti-Semitism accusations within Labour's membership, this prompted Hodge to call Corbyn an anti-Semite and racist.
Are we going to be talking about whether he is an anti-Semite or not? Or is that going to be libelous? Are you not going to let us do that?
No, we're definitely going to talk about that.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, how exciting. Oh, yeah. Consequences. And then finally, we're going to talk about the fact that I'm really worried about the future of UKIP. Probably because Nigel Farage isn't involved in it anymore and some scary people have joined.
I mean, so, Farage threatened to come back if the Brexit deal turned out to be Brexit in name only.
But he only cares about Brexit, whereas now some people who are associated with the alt-right have now joined. So
note the use of the word associated.
Yeah, there, we're not allowed. Jimmy's being a journalist and telling me I'm not allowed to say that they are alt-right.
So, well, I think there's a genuine intellectual honesty point there, but we will go into detail. Yeah.
So Paul Joseph Watson, who is probably the most attractive Nazi on the internet. Mark Beecham, who was known as Count Dankula. We've covered him before because he taught his pug how to do a Nazi salute after saying, "Gas the Jews." And then Carl Benjamin, friend of the podcast.
Friends might be pushing it.
Sargon of Akkad.
Previous.
Still our most listened to episode, Jimmy.
Previous guest of the podcast. It's definitely true. And he's a YouTuber. I mean, him and Watson are both YouTubers.
All three of them are YouTubers, okay. Really. So they have been linked to a lot of the alt-right kind of... They're basically seen as kind of part of the media wing. And they present kind of more of a savoury front and a logical kind of stoic breakdown of current politics and current society to make it seem like sending people back to where they came from is a sensible thing to do. Essentially?
Am I overstepping my bounds? We need to discuss this in depth, but yeah, that is one of the interpretations of their work for sure.
Right. So, well, it's mine.
The way they would describe it is that certainly true of Watson and Carl Benjamin.
So they've joined UKIP.
But they would describe themselves as classical liberals is the important point.
Great. How terrifying. So they've joined UKIP, that classical liberal bastion of British democracy.
So has also Milo Yiannopoulos.
Has he?
Yeah, the disgraced Milo Yiannopoulos is, I think, we're probably allowed to call.
Who basically said that, you're going to tell me off. He said that it was kind of fine that he was abused, he was sexually abused as a child, and that's kind of like a rite of passage for gay men. Anyway.
No, that's exactly what he said.
Good. So, excellent. I'm glad I don't have to pussyfoot around that. Yeah. They've joined UKIP, and it's kind of worrying because actually these guys have...
These guys know how to make great content.
They know how to make fantastic content. No, yeah, of course. I mean, the Sargon of Akkad episode is still our most listened to.
There you go.
And it's because of the quality of that content, that's why. But they... I'm worried about the fact that UKIP is going to turn from disgruntled, like, pensioners to... just the racists. But we'll talk about that later. How exciting.
Let's do that.
Music. And we beg you for money. and also give you an Audible link. Cool. Hello, if you like this podcast, then you will be able to find us on Patreon. Patreon is a monthly subscription service that allows you to basically tip us, give us a little bit of cash if you think that what we're doing is worthwhile. It helps us put money towards like hosting fees and new equipment and all of that kind of stuff because my laptop is dying. You can also, if you are so inclined, if you like audiobooks, you can listen to audio book and go to audible.com/writedishonorable and that gives us like a proceeds of the sign up fee. You get a month for free and then it reverts to normal. God, that was painful to describe, wasn't it? Anyway, please support the show in whatever way you can, even if it's just tweeting us out. That is also hugely helpful, or leaving us a review. But now back to the show. Jimmy, you surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, who knows, we'll soon find out. You defended Ash Sarkar for telling Piers Morgan, I'm literally a communist, you idiot. There were some people who were saying that somebody declaring that they were a communist was akin to somebody saying that they were a Nazi. And you said that that wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, so this was a tweet I sent out, which I guess you read.
I did. I believe I retweeted it, Jimmy. I'm very generous.
Yeah, super generous. Mm-hmm. Got to get that audience reach.
Yeah.
They said that, you know, a lot of people after Ash Sarkar said, I'm a communist, said that there should be as much opprobrium poured on people who identify as communists as people who identify as Nazis or fascists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because, as I referenced in the intro, a lot of communist regimes have killed a lot of people in pretty unpleasant ways.
Sometimes accidentally, sometimes on purpose. It kind of depends.
It happens, you know. Mm. And I think that there's a distinction between regimes that have, you know, sort of good intentions and fuck things up, as opposed to regimes that have bad intentions and fuck things up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, well, there's going to be a lot of discussing Nazis in the course of this podcast, but
yeah, we've already like broken Godwin's law, don't we?
A lot of the worst excesses of the Nazis were part of the original strategy, right? They were not.
Yeah, they went out to kill some Jews.
Yeah, they went out to you know, commit ethnic cleansing and create a, you know, Aryan super race and whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas the ideas behind communism, people identify as communists, are that it's a kind of like egalitarian thing. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. everyone should, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, or something like that. And so I don't think that communists deserve to be, people identify as communists. I don't think it should be assumed that they're actually sort of like, Stalinists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although there are some...
Or Maoists. Although there are plenty of Maoists.
There are people who do identify as Stalinists and Trotskyists is a bit different. We're sort of getting into the weeds of these weird sectarian divisions within communists and far leftists. But yeah, I don't think they should be treated the same because the intentions are very different. You could argue the results are quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly been some of the communist regimes, Stalin's particularly, and also Mao's China, have ended up killing as many people as the Nazis and other regimes. The results have certainly been terrible. And for that reason, I think you should be very sceptical about people who call themselves communists.
But especially Mao was more of a whoops than the transporting a load of Jewish people to kill them in really horrific ways.
I mean, the thing is,
I'm not sure. I don't know. Like, does the whoops matter? Does incompetence in government? Because Mao, a lot of the people who ended up dying under Mao were done so from the famine that happened. People were discouraged from working in the fields and were encouraged to try and produce iron in their back gardens. Spoiler, unless you're probably properly trained and qualified, you can't make iron in your back garden. And then there was a huge famine in China because nobody was producing food.
Mm.
And then so that's where like an awful lot of people died under Mao. There is a whoops there.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if we should be, should we be particularly more forgiving of regimes that fuck up than ones that are very, at least they're being honest.
Well,
at least Hitler was honest.
On a smaller scale, you know, like, if you kill somebody, whether you intended to do so or not matters for the purposes of punishment, right? So I don't see why that wouldn't apply to politics in a wider sense. But the way that a lot of communists think about their own politics is they think that they could create a communist utopian society
without, our one's going to be fine
without massive coercion from the government. And I mean, that's why I think they're naive, but naivety is very different from bad intentions.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
So I've followed Ash quite a lot, actually, and she's very articulate about her views and why she considers herself a communist. I don't necessarily think that a lot of people who read communism and understand communism would necessarily put her in that bracket. She promotes a very kind of like modern take, and it's kind of like a solution to a lot of the problems that she sees in the world at the moment. One of the things that I think she's particularly articulate about is the fact that automation and technology is changing the workforce and the way that people are able to earn money hugely. And she cites a lot of statistics about the number of jobs in the north that are going to go because of automation, and the number of jobs in particular sectors that are going to go because of automation. She thinks that we should kind of recenter all of our wealth, and basically, without saying the words universal basic income, she is advocating for a universal basic income. You don't necessarily need communism and full-blown communism, which is often an ideology, often uses, as you said, coercion and limits freedoms of individuals for you to be able to have a solution to the large amount of automation that you have with the development of these technologies, right?
I mean, any kind of welfare state
is a little bit communist. Everyone's a little bit communist.
It all involves coercion, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but then you could equally...
Coercion can be paying your taxes. Coercion can be, I mean, putting you in a jail.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like, you know, a taxes theft sort of guy, but tax only works if there's an implicit threat of violence behind the tax collector.
Yeah.
You know, that's... If nothing happens when you don't pay your taxes, they are not taxes. Mm-hmm. They are voluntary contributions.
Mm-hmm. Which is how nation states... I mean, in political theory, that the threat of violence is kind of one of the legitimacies of the nation state. And I don't want to get into like political theory, because I mean, there's too many people that do that.
True, but yeah, I you know, I think that I'm a bit of a skeptic around the IT automation point and how that's actually going to pare down in terms of jobs. But if that does happen, then something that looks like universal basic income has to be at this point one of the options. Mm-hmm. I think.
And also, we had an industrial revolution that was similarly disruptive in the way that people approached and dealt with work. And we ended up fine. Well, fine-ish. And I think that we often, when you're theorising about a future when there is an industrial or a technological revolution, it's very difficult for people to be able to hypothesise what is the future of work going to look like until it actually happens. Mm. Because there will be new work that is created off of the back of this type of automation. There will be new types of industries that come about because of the fact that there is less need for manual labour. And I think that it's particularly... It lacks an understanding of like how we have developed as societies when there have been these huge disruptions.
Hmm. I wanted to talk about the fact that Ash Sarkar and her colleagues at Navarra Media, Aaron Bastani, and I guess, you know, also Paul Mason as well.
Like, do you want to explain who Navarra Media are?
Yeah, Navarra Media are like a small independent media. They used to be a company.
Plucky upstarts.
Yeah, they... I'm not actually sure what their... Guido Fawkes, like, took a lot of glee in finding out that Navarra had been deregistered from Company's House for not filing their returns or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they're a small media outlet. They produce, like, YouTube videos and podcasts.
Long.
Yeah, and they're kind of more on the wonkish theoretical side. Like, it's very...
Mm-hmm. Socialist wonks.
Yeah, it's couched in like academic language and, you know, whatever. It's not that accessible.
Yeah, right.
I think you could say, but they've been sort of like Corbynites before Corbyn was a thing, right? And Corbyn's rise to the top of the Labour Party has actually given them a huge opportunity to actually, I mean, grow their own careers on a cynical level, but also have more influence. And they're being invited more readily on like BBC Newsnight and what have you. And I think that's just, it's just kind of interesting that the kind of Overton window, as far as like what the media thinks is a views that should be included on a programme, has obviously changed because of Jeremy Corbyn. And so, you know, the fact that somebody can go on TV and say, I'm a communist, and not be laughed out the room. You can debate how legitimate a communist she is, like, as you sort of said, that, you know, there are mainstream Guardian columnists that I actually think quite similar things to her.
I think that a certain amount of her claim to communism is like the shock value of it. Like,
she has an element of like the shock jock about her, right? Like, she deliberately like,
it makes me quite like her. I'd like her on the podcast. Hey, Ash.
Yeah, she's quite I want to use the word spunky, but I think I'm going to be accused of being a sexist.
I'm glad that you chose not to use that word to describe her, Jim.
Whatever is the non-sexist word for spunky, you know. She's quite opinionated and forceful.
I would take issue or disagree with the idea of them shifting the Overton window.
I don't think they've shifted it. I think the shift of the Overton window from Corbyn's election has created those conditions.
Okay, so I
should say
that
the Overton window is just a phrase for what is politically acceptable in any society at a given time, like what's realistically achievable.
And the idea is that also the Overton window can be expanded to include new like policy positions or anything by those on the fringes who advocate for that, but a little bit more. So Brexit, for a very long time, wasn't within the Overton window, and Farage kept on banging on the wall to make it actually part of it.
I think it was always an option as far as public opinion is concerned, but it wasn't an option within Westminster for a very long time.
Kind of like now. So I think that they are very good at expanding the what is politically acceptable for a specific demographic. They are often going to be younger. They are often going to be people who are already within the Labour Party. But I think that people like, not even my grandparents, but my parents are going to look at that and be actually kind of horrified of the use of the word communist like that. Whereas actually her opinions are not necessarily hugely controversial in terms of the way she talks about housing and the way she talks about the future of work. Do you think that there is an intention there, like, to be the shock jock that expands the way that we talk about politics in this country? Do you think she's basically kind of, hey, I'll be the figurehead that ends up pushing it? Or do you think that's happening because of the run-in she had with Piers Morgan?
I mean, I think she personally is a bit of an attention seeker, and that's kind of her style.
Hey, Jimmy, right? Jimmy, we have a podcast on the internet. We are also attention seekers.
No one listens to us, so it doesn't count.
Yeah, but I'd like it if they did.
It just strikes me that, you know, Owen Jones, who's another Corbyn outrider, Guardian columnist, who is loosely associated with these guys, you know, is friends with them, appears on their podcast and that sort of thing, has long said that actually Corbyn's ideas are not, a lot of them are not very radical. They are within the realms of public opinion. So a classic one is like
nationalisation of the rails.
The rails, yeah. Of the train franchises specifically.
Because the railways it's a very complicated system. Anyway.
But anyway, like, bringing the train network back fully into public ownership has been a popular idea among the British public for ages. But it's not been advocated by mainstream politicians until Corbyn became Labour leader. And I actually think that what Ash Sarkar is doing by describing herself as a communist is unhelpful to making those ideas more acceptable than Westminster.
Do you think that not to give her like advice, because I'm sure she's doing very well, but do you think it would be better and more fruitful for them to advocate for the policy positions like universal basic income or a more progressive like system for housing and that kind of stuff, rather than giving it an academic label?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I mean, it's part of the reason that we try and not to be too wonky with our language, which I'm sure
Do we try? Or is this just how we are? Are we just not intellectual enough, Jimmy?
I mean, you've almost finished a Master's at Oxford.
Yeah,
so,
I know, right? You'd expect me to be better at it.
Maybe. The more accessible, the better.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt they'll change because that's kind of the intellectual milieu that they've come from. We had Richard Seymour, who's like an old school socialist writer, who's also he has appeared on Navarra Media's podcast. We had him on our podcast ages ago, and he spoke in very elevated intellectual tones about things. Now, I think not to single him out, because there are a fair amount of people who do this. That doesn't help public understanding of things. It makes it needlessly complex.
Mm-hmm. And if anything, turns them off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of turning people off, I guess, Jeremy Corbyn's been accused of being an anti-Semite by Margaret Hodge. Explain what happened. Thanks.
So, Labour have just adopted a new definition of anti-Semitism, which deviates from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's own definition, which has a broad international acceptance.
Great. Long words. What's the original one?
The original what?
The original definition of anti-Semitism. The one that everybody uses. From the established people.
The established people, the IHRA. IHRA, try not to say RA. it's actually a list of he says scrolling down his phone 11 points, so it's not like a single one line thing,
right?
But it outlines,
surprise, racism is nuanced,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it includes things such as accusing the Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. And
nice specific one there. Yeah,
very specific. Yeah. Applying double standards by requiring of Israel behaviour not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation.
Mm-hmm.
Although I feel that happens to most countries at some point.
Yeah,
so,
that's something a bit broad.
Yeah, so it's a mixture of sort of the broad and the specific. But the one of the particular ones that actually Labour have sought to contest, and this does play into Corbyn's own views, is number 7, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, e.g. by claiming that the existence of a state of Israel is a racist endeavour.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the one of the things that...
This is based on the perception that Israel is an ethnic state.
Mm. Yes.
Cool. Which isn't true. People who aren't Jewish are Israeli.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in terms of their treatment of the Palestinians, that, to some degree could be argued to be it's certainly a religious thing.
Nuance. Cool.
So anyway, Labour have... They've changed a couple of things. So they've omitted describing the... I'm reading this from the Jewish Chronicle. Describing the, quote, dual loyalties trope. That is, accusing Jews of having allegiance to some, wider Jewish movement rather than whatever country they're residing in as anti-Semitic. And they've also, as I said, they've omitted three examples of how Christians in Israel can be anti-Semitic, such as claiming the existence of the state of Israel as a racist endeavour. And this is partly against the backdrop of wider anti-Semitism accusations against Labour members.
Mm-hmm.
And there haven't been...
This is Labour members who are, members who have paid to join the party rather than generally members of Parliament.
Yeah, not MPs.
Yeah.
Although there are some questions,
it's short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you know what I mean? This is... it's kind of based against that. And... The Jewish Chronicle, in its leader this week, actually called for Jewish MPs within Labour to leave the party and form their own independent bloc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that won't happen, but there is a huge amount of anger from various Jewish bodies. I think that 60-odd rabbis have signed a letter protesting what Labour have done. And it's just fed into this general story that Labour is... Corbyn is at the very least not listening or not heeding the concerns of many Jewish people as far as anti-Semitism in the party goes.
Is this So the things that have kind of been reassessed by this Labour code of conduct are specifically based around the State of Israel question.
Some of them are, yeah. There's a couple of other things, but
this is like the crux of it, right? They want to be able to criticise Israel without people saying that they're anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Now, I do think it's possible to criticise Israel without being anti-Semitic, and I think we've done it on this podcast before. What is it specifically about the way that people who follow Corbyn or Corbyn himself has criticised Israel that makes people worried about the criticisms that they have?
I think that there's a major thing around Corbyn's foreign policy history, and in terms of the groups he's been associated with, and has
Hamas,
mm-hmm. who's spoken, if not favourably, then certainly sympathetically about. Mm-hmm. And he has a general, I'd say, anti-American, anti-English yeah. kind of bias to his reading of foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Like he, and you know, I think that, you know, Israel.
Let's be fair, we have been dicks in the past.
I mean, you know, it's not been an unblemished record.
Beautiful way of putting it.
But Israel is grouped into that, and I think that there's kind of a school of left-wing thought that Israel is kind of just an arm of US foreign policy, mm-hmm. Or alternatively that the US is just an arm of Israeli foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And that
tail wags dog or dog wags tail.
Exactly, yeah. And because of that, they've been very, some would say, even hypercritical of Israel, to the extent that some of them don't really think that Israel should have been set up as a state, mm-hmm. you know, a Jewish homeland for Jewish people to live after the Second mm-hmm. World War. Mm-hmm. I don't think that view is innately anti-Semitic, personally. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there are anti-Semites who would, you know, put forward that view. And it's, politically speaking, very difficult to make any argument around that without risking being accused of being anti-Semite.
I think hugely because they are the only Jewish nation.
Yeah.
Right?
But, I mean, you know, in many ways, we want to move away from any conception of, you know, nation states being viewed as purely for mm-hmm. one ethnicity.
I mean, we would in, I think, a liberal, progressive Europe, for example. But I think that divorcing of religious or even ethnic identity from a nationality is really, really difficult in other parts of the world. That I sometimes
think I think it's difficult here. You know?
Yeah, no, it's so, often difficult here.
Yeah.
I mean, like the US even has, even though secularism is written into its constitution, is, surprise, surprise, super Christian.
Mm.
And you have China where it's incredibly, like, even if I got Chinese citizenship, I'd never be seen as Chinese because you have to be Han Chinese or one of the 52 minorities there in order to be part of that nation. And I think that it's this kind of idealistic utopian vision of what a nation state can be in terms of being pluralistic and in terms of being like accepting and balanced is something that we have in Western Europe a lot more than we do in other parts of the world, and especially in turbulent parts of the world like the Middle East. I'm not saying that Israel comports itself particularly well. I'm not saying that that is the way that I think that a nation state should be run. But we,
I mean, but at the same time, they are surrounded by neighbours who are very hostile to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know,
it was also our fault for putting them there.
My understanding is the British kind of set it up and then left the Americans to deal with it.
Yep. Okay. We've got this bit just at the edge of the Mediterranean. Do you guys want it? There you go. Have fun. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah, I think so. I do kind of have some sympathy with left-wing critics of, you know, Israel in that sense, but I also think that Corbyn has done a great deal, you know, even purely by negligence, he's enabled a lot of anti-Semitism within the party, just by not criticising it strongly enough, by just generally being quite inactive and
inert.
Do
you think he has not criticised it strongly enough? Do you think that actually it's the way that this is being portrayed in the media? Maybe he is actually having a bit of an iron fist and we just aren't really seeing it because the narrative of Corbyn is an anti-Semite kind of works at the moment.
The trouble with Corbyn is if you ask him to condemn violence on one side,
yeah,
he will condemn all violence. You know, kind of in a slightly Trumpish way, mm-hmm. even. You know, and I'd, because I think he was asked about this a couple of times, and maybe he said something, you know, specific about anti-Semitism that I'm not aware of. But when asked about anti-Semitism, he often just says, "I condemn all forms of racism."
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I think it's a bit rich, the Tories going after Labour for racism problems, for fairly obvious reasons.
Go on.
What, you want me to elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, no.
I mean, you know...
We're meant to be not the wonks, we're meant to make this accessible.
I mean, the Tories, Zach Goldsmith was standing as Tory mayor against...
Mayoral candidate,
I should say.
Sadiq Khan, who is... a Muslim.
He is a Muslim. Yeah.
He is a Muslim. Yeah.
And they sought to inflame some of the concerns of the Sikh community around...
The Sikh and Hindu communities,
In Tower Hamlets, I think. And I don't, as far as I'm aware, Labour have never done anything along those lines, or at least not in recent history.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, we'd expect Labour to be more vigilant against racism than the Tories, given the general political leanings. And I don't think Corbyn hates Jewish people. I just think he's kind of lax on the subject. I think
Think that it's really a problem. Who was it who said that anti-Semitism isn't as much of a problem as homophobia or racism because so many Jewish people are rich and in positions of power? Is that that's a narrative I've definitely heard, but I don't know who to attribute it to.
I mean, it's not dissimilar from the view that, you know, attacking white Anglo-Saxon Protestants is okay because, they're generally a privileged group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can have privilege and still be the victim of a racist attack.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Or anti-Semitism. I'm not sure how I feel about there being white racism. I don't think that really exists.
I mean, most Jewish people are white, aren't they?
It's a weird thing, isn't it? It's almost like race was made up by some fucking Victorians.
I mean, it does have some biological underpinnings, doesn't it?
Not
really. That's why you can take a DNA test and they can tell you, oh, your ancestors came from this part of the world.
Yeah, but I can't see your chromosomes, Jimmy.
No, I'm not, you know...
like, it is based on somebody's, like, facial structure and skin colour.
There are, like, biological aspects to race. I'm not saying you know... It's not entirely made up. Like, most of the... There's a lot of bullshit, you know, on the top, but... To say that it's entirely, like...
But race is the concept of a race is something that we have made up. Biological differences between people who come from different places and have different chromosomes and have different coloured skin, they obviously exist. But we decided to put them into little buckets and for those buckets to have characteristics.
Mm.
And that, my friend, is made up.
Yes.
Yes, good. Excellent. We can agree. It when we do that.
I think we were very angry at each other there, like, despite the fact we held the same opinion.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like occasionally you need there to be a little bit of tension.
Okay.
Shall we talk about the future of UKIP?
Speaking of racism.
Oh, you beat me to it.
The segues here just become better and better as time goes on. Yeah, so these, as we said at the start of the podcast, Paul Joseph Watson, Mark Meacham, and...
Friend of the podcast,
Carl Benjamin. Guest on the podcast, I think, would be better than friend. But I don't know...
I thought you quite got on with him.
Well, I thought he was a nice guy, but I don't want to, you know...
Yeah, but then the mic went off. Anyway.
Anyway, they've joined UKIP now, and they've done it... I think they've done it explicitly because Paul Joseph Watson said something to the effect of they're the only party that supports free speech.
Free speech, right, yeah.
Are you aware of UKIP's policy on free speech?
No, but isn't it nice that there's nobody in UKIP anymore so they can decide what UKIP's policy on free speech is going to be?
Is there no one? No one votes for UKIP anymore. But although
they have gone up since the Chequers agreement,
they have. Yeah,
because I mean, some people just want to see the world burn. But who's the? Go on, tell me who's the leader of UKIP?
Gerard Batten.
Okay, you're a bad person to ask. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that about 20 minutes ago. They are a shell of a party at the moment. They had, before this recent surge because of Brexit things, from about 1% to 8%.
Yeah, so some context. In 2015 general election, they got 4 million votes
yes.
and one seat.
Yes.
Which was held by a defecting Tory and right. was kind yeah. of won on his mandate
yeah,
rather
he
than
was,
UKIP's.
He was quite... what was his name?
Douglas Carswell.
Douglas Carswell.
Yeah.
I actually quite liked him. He is a classic liberal.
Yeah, he's a libertarian mm-hmm. Brexiter. So, and then in 2017 election, they just fell to bits. I can't remember how many votes they got, but
right,
the vote,
they tanked.
The vote
because everybody who wanted Brexit voted mm-hmm. Tory.
And in that time, Nigel Farage left the party mm-hmm. and then had to, sorry, resigned as leader, came back as leader because
yeah,
the
yeah.
his follow-up quit after 8 days or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
I'm losing the timeline here. They had a lot of leaders, and Farage was there more than once. And now Gerard Batten's in charge, and they've been languishing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they've recently got media coverage because of these YouTubers mm, joining, and also because of, as you say, reaction to the Chequers deal.
But they've joined, so these YouTubers, these influencers.
Influencers.
God, they're my people. It's in that we both put videos on the fucking internet.
Yeah. I don't think you have to be responsible for everyone who's ever put a video on YouTube.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to divorce me from the activities of Count Dankula. They are joining because there is an empty shell of a party there. There's a lot of really great infrastructure in UKIP, actually. It's a party that works in terms of administration. And rather than starting their own party that would then have to build an organ to be able to do a lot of the stuff that they want to do, be able to run in elections, have people who are competent when it comes to, I mean, you can say what you like about competent councillors, but all of that apparatus is already there, and they get to like jump into some kind of driving seat, and then
I mean, are they going to be in the driving seat? I sort of feel that they've joined. I don't know that they'll do very much now that they're part of the party.
Do you not think so? I mean, I don't think any of them have any desire to be elected officials, but I think that the power that they will then have over the people who are the elected officials is the scary thing.
Well, I think they did it as a stunt. Like, they joined... I mean,
the clickbait worked. I clicked on the video.
It was kind of coordinated. Like, mm-hmm. they agreed among themselves that they would join, or at least one joined, and then others followed. But they're not culturally... in terms of, you know, how they probably think a party should be run. I don't know that they're a good fit for UKIP.
But I think that there is overlap for the people who have those views about freedom of speech. I think that if they were going to go anywhere, it's like the right/libertarian part of the Tory party, like the Liz Trusses and the Dominic Raabs, like that's kind of like the libertarian wing.
I mean, if
you bleed over into UKIP,
if you're
and they don't want to be
if
Tories.
If you're an actual classical liberal, you'd be far better off joining the Tories, I think.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. But they describe themselves as classical liberals, but I think that we both know they're bloody not. Classical liberal, by the way, define.
Essentially, someone who believes in a small state, as few laws as possible, so, you know, provided the country still runs. I mean, classical liberals can have variable views on, say, military intervention and stuff like that, but in terms of how domestic politics works, low regulation,
mm-hmm.
You know, free speech, civil liberties, etc.
Mm-hmm. These all sound like lovely things to a lot of people. Why are we worried about these guys joining UKIP then? Go and say the alt-right.
So, okay, first point, like, Carl Benjamin, when he appeared, Sargon of Akkad, when he appeared on this podcast, described himself as a classical liberal, but he's also he said he was in favour of the NHS, the welfare state. Those are not classically liberal positions by any stretch.
And actually, that means that he probably aligns with UKIP quite well, because they believe in a strong state like that.
Yeah, in that respect. So that's kind of a sidebar, but in terms of... the phrase alt-right, and I got into a little bit of an argument after I did my interview with the academic agent,
mm-hmm.
which you can see on the podcast feed, because he's someone who is loosely related to this world. I think he's a friend of Sargon of Akkad. And the phrase alt-right, when it originally came into being, the first time I was aware of it was when Milo Yiannopoulos wrote something about it for Breitbart.
Mm-hmm.
And he described it as a very broad church. There were sort of like... there were people who were frankly racists, there were people who were nationalists, there, and there was also sort of free speech campaigners, and it was a huge, very broad church. And over time, it's been narrowed down purely to describe the kind of white supremacist, fascist element of it.
The "You Will Not Replace Us" guys from Charlotte.
Yeah, from Charlottesville, yeah. And so now, like, I mean, Paul Joseph Watson, there are tweets of his, I think you can still find them, where he describes himself as alt-right, but those were years ago, and I think he meant it in the old context. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It was used to describe media-savvy, techie, young right-wingers who wouldn't fit sort of a traditional conservative sensibility in terms of being, like, social conservatives or, you know, even that being like neoliberal, free market Tories necessarily, although they're more closely aligned to that last group. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of seen as a new trend. Mm-hmm. And then, this was ages ago. This was well before Trump got elected. And I think that a lot of them now disown the term alt-right, although mm-hmm.
But they're still seen as kind of like an alt-light. See what I did there? Very clever.
I think alt-light is actually used as an insult by...
Oh, really, is
it's,
it?
It's used as an insult by people who... By, say, white supremacists mm-hmm. about people who...
But they are often seen as kind of like a soft landing into the type of views and ideologies that end up leading people into, like, racist ideologies and, like, starting these conversations around, like, freedom of speech. You are being... I mean, the whole, like, replacement narrative and... all of that.
Things there are conservatives, like fairly mainstream conservatives. I'm thinking of like Mark Stein, who's a Canadian commentator, and even Douglas Murray, who's a British mm-hmm. writer for The Spectator over here, who will talk about things like, they won't necessarily use the phrase sort of white replacements, but they'll talk about things like Muslim migration and birth rates mm-hmm. among white mm-hmm. white people and the decline of Christianity in public life. And I don't want to say that they're sort of using dog whistle terms for that, because I think their views are actually different in some ways. But there's kind of a spectrum, right, mm-hmm, between mm-hmm. those more sophisticated expression of, say, isn't our civilization slightly on the decline? And then the more brutish, mm-hmm. blunt version of that, which does include white supremacists.
Mm-hmm. There's more white people than there've ever been. I quite like.
I mean, there's more slaves than there've ever been as well. Because of population growth.
Oh, mind blown. What do you think this means for UKIP? Especially now that they're kind of on the... I don't think they're necessarily on the rise. I think it's just all of the hardcore Brexiters who are going back and saying that they're going to vote for them.
I think a UKIP resurgence is far more likely in the event of some sort of Brexit shenanigan and the return of Nigel Farage, and I think it is under these guys, to be honest. I just don't see them as like a... I don't think it'll work. I don't think that they'll get involved and reinvigorate the party and, you know, overhaul all the infrastructure.
Not like be a Steve Bannon for UKIP, for Prime Minister Farage.
I mean, Steve Bannon was never really a Republican, was he? He worked on the Trump campaign.
Well, no, neither's Trump, really.
Yeah. So I think that comparison sort of proves the point.
I think we do have kind of like that stopgap in British politics, because we aren't really voting for whoever becomes Prime Minister and whoever leads like whatever party. We have those infrastructures that kind of save us from there being something like a Trump. Our version of that was obviously Brexit, but it's okay because it's not going to happen. and also like people are only gonna, they're not gonna get the amount of attentional power that they currently have as digital influencers if they were to go into mainstream politics.
UKIP are
never going to be one of the big two parties. That's just not really how
it's not really like what the spectrum there for, is.
Yeah, it's not what they're there for. I think that you need a lot to change in our the way that we do politics for that to actually be the case and for them to be influential.
I think if they were genuinely interested in promoting free speech, as I said, they'd be far better off joining and trying to influence the Tory party. Mm-hmm. Because there is like a libertarian, classical liberal caucus within the Tories.
Yeah,
I think Liz Truss is actually...
Liz Truss is. Dominic Raab as well. Priti Patel.
Yeah. There's a couple of think tanks that have been set up recently to kind of pursue that. And,
you know, great.
There's, you know, there's stuff happening. you kind of like teased about the Brexit thing. Do you genuinely think it won't happen?
I've already given you my prediction, Jimmy.
You're sure it won't happen?
No. I think that there is going to be either a... am I going to have to keep on saying this at the end of every podcast?
Possibly, yeah.
There's going to be either an election or a people's vote. Sorry, not a second referendum. A people's vote by the end of the year.
A second people's vote after the first one.
Correct. That's what I'm predicting and that's what I'm sticking to.
I like the branding, but it's like quite a disingenuous piece of branding, don't you think? Like,
well, so is democracy, let's be fair.
I mean, you could argue, but...
Rule of the people, fuck that shit.
You know, the people have spoken, let's keep asking them questions.
Yeah, I'm down. More democracy. We want more.
Maybe a referendum every quarter?
So we're Sweden. Not Sweden, Switzerland. The other, yeah. SW. Shall we finish?
I think so, yeah.
Where can they find you on the internet, Jimmy?
You can still find
Tell them about that podcast you did.
Oh, I did mention the Academic Agent interview that I did as part of our spin-off on The Fringe.
Ooh, like it.
Yeah.
It's very well named.
Yeah, someone took issue with that and said that I was trying to portray, you know, people I was interviewing as nutters who, like...
They are.
Okay.
They're on the podcast.
Well, there is that.
We can confirm nobody sane has ever... No.
But yeah, I did a live stream with him that you can find if you go to his YouTube channel. Just search Academic Agent. We spoke for 2 hours just around.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was
That's too long, Jimmy.
Well, you know, conversation was flowing.
Oh,
it's going well.
I don't.
He's far more interesting than you, so.
And
we also, you know, we did speak about our dynamic as me as a Leave voter, you as a SJW Remainer.
Well, now so. I'm. What's the timestamp for that? So I don't have to.
Towards the end.
Okay, cool, excellent.